From WUOT News, this is The Method, a series exploring the intersection of science and society. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. In a moment, the age-old battle between parents and children over bedtime. But first, you might use social media to tell your friends what you had for lunch today or share photos of your dog. But scientists at Oak Ridge National Laboratory are using social media and other data sets to track infectious and chronic diseases. WUOT's Chrissy Kuiper spoke with Laura Pullum. She's a senior researcher working on this effort.
What diseases do you look at particularly?
Influenza. We had a pandemic in 2009-2010, so that started a push for research in that area. The techniques can be used for other diseases, chronic diseases, asthma, and other infectious diseases.
How does it work?
Well, Orbit takes information, data from publicly available data sets, say Twitter streams of people talking about what's bothering them, prescription drug sales, and other data. We're collaborating with the Knox County Health Department and have gotten some of their data to run through our tool set and to see what insights we may be able to discover from that.
You're taking all of this information and you're plugging it in, but what is the computation that's happening? What is the computer looking at?
Correlations between a vast number of variables, and then can determine where a disease might strike, particularly influenza. What are the leading indicators of influenza? A leading indicator has been asthma, a peak in asthma, especially at the beginning of the flu season, the school season, can indicate the severity or the peak of that flu for that season.
Has there ever been a method like this before?
There are lots of tools out there, like Google Flu, Flu View from the CDC. One thing that distinguishes Orbit is that we can handle more different types of data than the other tools, and we can handle both streaming data that comes in a stream like Twitter data, Instagram, and static data in databases, and current data that public health organizations would have. Also, we take electronic health claims data and include that in it.
So like insurance claims?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So we also have to understand the bias in those different data sets, right? For something that is based on the public searches, say Google Flu Trends, it can be swayed or biased by media reports. So if NPR or CDC or CNN have a report that the flu is going to be particularly bad this year, then there will be a spike in the searches for flu disease. What do I look for? How do I prevent? That type of thing. However, we can take that bias out. So we normalize that bias.
How do you normalize that bias, as you say?
Well, we understand the baseline. There's a baseline of what people generally talk about, and it has ebbs and flows and fluctuations. But we can also correlate with the news feeds and the news stories and see if that spike is occurring at the same time or is closely correlated with that news feed.
Gotcha. Where those influences are.
Yes. Yeah. Using social media as an indicator is better for those diseases that are more prevalent, like the flu, rather than, say, West Nile virus, because it's more rare occurrence.
August means going back to school. For many parents, it also means early mornings and cranky teens. But before you give your teenager a lecture about sleep, you ought to know sleepiness isn't about sloth. It's really about biology. Here with the commentary is sleep researcher Teresa Lee, Dean of the University of Tennessee College of Arts and Sciences.
These changes that you're describing, this difference from adults, begins at the onset of puberty, so around the age of 11 to 14, depending on the child, and the peak difference occurs between 19 and 22 years of age. As you go into adolescence and the high growth phase, students, kids, all kids, need to be sleeping between 9 and 10 hours a night. But at the same time, they're delaying when they start to sleep. And that is why they're so sleepy in the morning. It's not that the morning part isn't the change, it's the lack of sleep. Your parents are right. You need to get more sleep. But the problem is your body isn't letting you go to sleep at that 8:30, 9 or 9:30 time. You're staying awake until 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning as you go through adolescence. And again, it is worse for boys than it is for girls on average. And boys take longer than girls to start to recover from this and start to look like other adults. So what's the best thing we can do? Well, the best thing we could do is to actually let them get their 9 or 10 hours of sleep, starting at a reasonable bedtime for them. And there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, can we shift them? Well, we can do some things to help. It's certainly worse in our culture where kids are often looking at computer screens or have lights on, playing TV games, whatever, into the evening. And one recommendation that we would make to families is during middle school, when this first hits, have a family rule that a half an hour before the expected bedtime, all electronics go off. Computers go off, phones go off, video games go off, so that the light from those things which stimulate wakefulness goes off. You can read a book, you can have a desk lamp. You know, begin the process of winding down. We do this with our little children sort of instinctively. We have bath time, reading time, songs. We get the child ready for bed by winding them down and into a routine. And we sort of let teenagers go their own way and don't pay much attention to the fact that all of us need this kind of bedtime routine and getting rid of light. So that can help perhaps keep it from getting so late into the evening before they go to bed. And fortunately, there's a move now for school districts to start their days later. And so kids are getting a bit more sleep. So when you live in a rural school district, like my kids did, many kids start driving to school when they're 16 years old. Car accidents are much more common in the morning at that age, and they go down when school starts later. Students are more likely to show up for their first hour classes. They do better in their first hour classes when they're later. The other thing that I definitely recommend is that short naps are helpful. And I mean short naps, not the kind where the student comes home and goes to sleep for 2 hours. That disrupts their nightly sleep. But a half an hour nap can be reviving and help you think better in the evening when you're doing your homework and not disrupt your ability to go to bed at whatever that reasonable hour might be.
That does it for this edition of The Method. You can listen to all of our past shows at wuot.org. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.